Middle East Eye also had an eye on this issue, writing, Canadian Muslim groups are raising concerns about a recent attack in which an imam was allegedly assaulted during a morning prayer service in Toronto. The Islamic Foundation of Toronto said recently that an intruder had entered the mosque and disrupted the dawn prayer by assaulting the imam before two brave congregants quickly held him back and called 911. In its statement, the mosque condemned the attack and called on the police to keep all avenues of investigation open. Our hearts are deeply troubled, and we know that many in our community are deeply concerned after an incident took place this morning, the official statement read. However, the center said there was not enough information to know what the motivation of the attack was. We understand that this is a difficult and scary time for our community. We must stress, however, that we simply do not have enough information to assess what led to this incident, the Islamic Center said. Toronto police are investigating the matter and have yet to charge the individual. The police said on Twitter that it investigates all potential hate crimes fully and that if charges are laid, it will provide an update to the case. The imam, Yusuf Barat, released a statement saying that he and many of his congregants remain traumatized, in fear, and very worried after the incident. He said, I pray that no individual or community ever face what horrific incident the IFD congregation and myself have experienced this morning. The National Council of Canadian Muslims and Canada's Council of Imams, CCI, also expressed their concerns over the incident. The CCI's statement said, the bravery of the congregants to prevent this ugly incident from escalating is truly remarkable, and CCI strongly encourages all congregants to continue their increased vigilance. Experts in Canada previously told MEE that Canada has witnessed decades of anti-Muslim rhetoric, both from politicians and in the media. Islamophobic and anti-Muslim attacks have also surged in recent years, the most high-profile being the mass shooting at Quebec City Mosque in 2017, where a white Canadian man shot and killed six people. An August report from Statistics Canada found that hate crimes against Muslim communities across the country increased by 71% in 2021. The government study found that the number of recorded attacks against Muslims rose from 84 incidents in 2020 to 144 in 2021. The jump in attacks followed a decline from the previous year, as in 2019, there was a total of 182 reported incidents targeting Muslims. A recent study from October tracked networks peddling Islamophobia throughout Canada over the past 4 years. The 240-page report outlined an ecosystem composed of media outlets, Islamophobia influencers, white nationalist groups, fringe, right-wing pro-Israel groups, security experts, think tanks, and the donors who fund their campaigns. While several reports have outlined the Islamophobia industry in the U.S., this study is the one of the first to deeply look into Islamophobia networks in Canada.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, but the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor, which show that its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
Let's talk about Dimona. Many people say, well, nobody knows.
You see, I blush, you say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But
why?
Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo, it's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex away from the public eye employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers. And we go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with this element of weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical, and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
Want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world?
Is transmitted at the request of the.
Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching a nuclear plant is a high risk. The highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. A barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
It says don't go off the road. Military zone, no photography.
Finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. An exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona nuclear plant.
That's the gate. Go inside.
Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona nuclear plant. and all of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
It was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a civic center of research, what it was called, a civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you built something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, you see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile things, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph. While the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time, the security eye was not that strong. So I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover, as you see here. You can go up to the roof under cover. There's a kind of...
This message is transmitted at the request of the United States
when
Office
President
of
Kennedy
Defense.
Took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the U.S. Secretary of Defense informs the president that based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the six floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we travelled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xanthe Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Positions for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xanthia Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona. Its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact, what are they doing about cooling, where is the nuclear waste being stored, how is it being stored, and all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty, a way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media, and so on. So we know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what conditions. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Dahriya, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Dahriya, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up, and at that point it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my, estimations are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor, and the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take lead samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel. And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one of funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. This is, if they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they are more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al-Khalil Hills, there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. This and many other cases come from the same region.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Every day, a large number of Yemeni children die because of malnutrition caused by the war in Yemen and also by the shortage of health and medical equipment in the country. The United Nations also announced in a report that hunger and lack of medical and health equipment are still the most important challenges that Yemeni children are facing. Mothers and newborn babies are the biggest victims of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has more for us. An official with Yemen's health ministry said more than 80 newborn babies lose their lives on a daily basis in Yemen because Yemen does not have the required medical equipment due to the Saudi-led war in the country. Najib Al-Qubati, the Undersecretary of Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population, made the remark on Thursday, 17th of November, while addressing a local event. Al-Qubati said, some 39% of babies are prematurely born, which shows a significant increase compared to the period before the start of the war in Yemen. The official said the use of prohibited weapons was one of the reasons behind the growing trend in Yemen. He said several human rights organizations have already acknowledged and condemned Saudi Arabia's use of such weapons. He said Yemeni medical centers are in need of some 2,000 incubators, noting that 632 incubators have been provided so far. According to the Cluster Munitions Monitor, since launching the war with the support of Washington in March of 2015, the Saudi Arabia-led coalition has used internationally banned weapons, including American-made cluster bombs, to target residential areas in Yemen. Apart from the war, Saudi Arabia has imposed a blockade on Yemen, which, combined, have claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The military aggression has destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, including its healthcare sector. Recently, the Yemeni health ministry said mosquito-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever have been on the rise in the country. Speaking at a press conference in Hodeidah, Mohammed Al-Mansour, the Undersecretary of Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population, said war and blockade were two main reasons behind the increase in epidemics and diseases in the country. Mohamed Al-Mansour said failure to implement malaria control program led to a rise in the cases of the disease from 513,000 in 2015 to 1,100,000 in 2019, noting the rate was higher in areas where citizens were displaced, such as in Hodeidah. He said malaria and dengue fever claimed the lives of more than 260,000 Yemenis between 2015 and 2019, naming the closure of ports, which has led to delays in the arrival of medical equipment and medicine, as one of the main reasons for the rise. In September, Yemen's Al Masira television network reported the Ministry of Public Health and Population had confirmed the Saudi-led blockade had raised acute malnutrition cases in Yemen to more than 632,000 among Yemeni children under the age of 5, and 1.5 million pregnant and lactating women. We have more on this from the website of UNICEF, unicef.org. More than one woman and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen from complications during pregnancy or childbirth. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said, bringing life into the world in Yemen can all too often turn into a tragedy for entire families. She added, decades of underdevelopment and years of intense fighting have left essential public services in Yemen, including crucial healthcare for mothers and babies, on the brink of total collapse. The maternal mortality rate has also risen sharply since the escalation of the conflict in Yemen, from 5 maternal deaths a day in 2013 to 14 maternal deaths a day in 2020. Access to quality anti- and postnatal health services is key to newborn and maternal survival. In the absence of adequate services, and because of lack of access and affordable transport costs, community healthcare workers are fast becoming providers of last resort for women and children, especially in remote, rural, and war-affected areas of Yemen. However, they too face challenges such as insecurity and a lack of supplies and transport. Half of all healthcare facilities in Yemen are not functional because of staff shortages, lack of medical supplies, inability to meet operational costs, or limited access. Those still running face severe shortages in medicine, medical equipment, and staff, putting lives at risk. Working with partners on the ground, UNICEF is supporting community-based service delivery and primary healthcare facilities with a focus on continuous care before and during the pregnancy, around the time of childbirth and afterbirth for both mother and baby. At the community level, UNICEF and partners are supporting community midwives and healthcare volunteers to provide case management of common childhood illnesses and home-based maternal and newborn care. UNICEF's Henrietta Fore said, antenatal care and skilled health attendants at delivery are essential to the survival of both mother and child. Adding, we renew our call for all children in Yemen and elsewhere in the world to enjoy their full rights to health, education, protection, and peace. Russia Today has also covered the same story. Red Cross official Bashir Omar says the humanitarian situation in Yemen is one of an unimaginable horror, with two-thirds of the population deprived of basic health care, calling on the international community not to leave the Yemeni people alone facing their fate. With the armed conflict in Yemen now in its 8th year, The International Committee of the Red Cross released a report recently stating that around 66% of Yemen's 30.5 million population lack access to basic health care, and those in need of medical attention often risk death to visit the 51% of healthcare facilities still operating in the country. The crisis has been most acutely felt by Yemeni women and children. The report read less than 50% of births in Yemen are attended by healthcare professionals, and more than one mother and six newborn babies die every 2 hours in Yemen. Of the estimated 4.2 million people displaced in Yemen since the outbreak of the war in 2015, 73% are women and children. Red Cross official Bashir Omar said, "It's just unimaginable horror. We are doing our best to draw the attention of the international community to the plight of the Yemeni people. We're saying that the world should not turn a blind eye to what is happening in Yemen." Bashir Omar, who authored the International Committee of Red Cross's report, continued by saying, "The Yemeni people should not be left alone facing their fate." Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population said the siege and intense bombardment with prohibited weapons cause a high rate of congenital abnormalities and miscarriages in Yemen, with an average of 350,000 miscarriages and 12,000 malformations. According to Yemen's health ministry, the Saudi-imposed blockade has led to an 8% increase in premature births compared to the situation before the war started in Yemen. The blockade has also increased the number of cancer patients by 50%. The figure showed 46,204 cases registered during 2021. Yemen's health ministry said the Saudi-led war had destroyed 162 health facilities in Yemen completely, and 375 were partially destroyed or were put out of work.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. We rely on no one for our security. We have succeeded in creating and maintaining this security with the strength that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us. Allah's grace, the support of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the support of the nation, and the persistence of the officials in the armed forces. He who relies on a foreign power should understand that foreign power will abandon him one day. The foreign power neither can nor wants to protect you. So these were a few words about the issues concerning the armed forces. Remember them. Be proud of yourselves. Follow these recommendations. Do your job in a way that brings God satisfaction and do your work for the sake of God.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
And now, for a few words about recent events. The first thing I'd like to state is that in the events that have taken place over these last few days, the officers working in the country's law enforcement, the Basij, and the Iranian nation have been wronged more than anyone else. They wronged us. Of course, the Iranian nation was present and very strong in this event too, as it has been in other events. And it will continue to do the same in the future. Whenever the enemies plan on creating unrest anywhere, it will be the courageous and faithful people of Iran who will stand up to them the most. They will be the ones who will have the most influence. They will come onto the scene as they have done before. Yes, the Iranian nation has been wronged, but at the same time, it is strong. It is strong like its pious master, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was the strongest, and yet he was the one who was wronged the most. In the incident that took place, a young girl passed away. Well, it was a bitter event. It saddened me very much too.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Almost all European countries are severely affected by the recent economic slump in the continent, but some countries are experiencing the worst economic recession in their history. There are new reports that Sweden's property market has plummeted amid a slowing consumption. Sweden is currently facing worst economic slump in EU. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted a severe slump in Sweden's real estate sector threatens to deepen a looming economic crisis in the Nordic region's largest economy. The outlet warned that after nearly 20 years of stable growth, the country's property market is undergoing a dramatic change. Housing prices have plunged by 15% from their peak in nominal terms this year, driven by surging inflation and rising borrowing costs, it said. Swedish consumers have cut spending drastically amid an unfolding cost of living crisis. This has brought more pain to the property sector, where economists now expect a decline in housing prices to surpass the forecast 20% drop-off. Sweden's housing market is the most vulnerable among EU states due to the country's monetary policy, which has a faster path through here than in other countries. An economist at Swedbank, Maria Wallin Fredholm, was quoted as saying, "The report indicated that about 64% of Swedes own their houses, but most people don't have long-term fixed-rate mortgages. They are therefore exposed to rising interest rates, which are now at their highest levels in more than a decade, following a series of hikes by the country's central bank. Fears are mounting that consumer spending will grind to a halt. Retail sales, along with lending, are plummeting, and there are no positive signals from the domestic economy, and especially not from households or the housing market." Annika Vins, the chief economist at Nordea Bank, warned, "Household debt as a percentage of Sweden's gross domestic product stands at 90%, according to Bloomberg, meaning that higher borrowing costs will have a severe impact on consumption." A more acute risk may lie in the commercial real estate market, the Bloomberg article says, with commercial lending accounting for up to 36% of the loan books at Sweden's major financial institutions. A severe downturn in this sector could put significant pressure on the country's banks, the outlet warns. Economists warn that the situation in the property market could deteriorate further if inflation persists. Sweden is now at risk of falling into the worst recession among the 27 countries comprising the EU, analysts believe. Bloomberg had this headline in its website, writing, "Sweden's free-falling property market triggers worst economic slump in EU." According to Bloomberg, soaring inflation and rising borrowing costs have sent housing prices on a steep downward trajectory across the world. But one of the places where this trend is playing out the fastest is Sweden. After a decades-long property boom fueled by cheap credit, a shortage of housing and interest-only mortgages, the Nordic region's largest economy is now in the midst of a sharp housing market contraction that threatens to deepen a looming economic slump. Home prices are down as much as 12% from their peak earlier this year when adjusted for seasonal variations, or as much as 15% in nominal terms. The plunge is happening so quickly that real-world declines could exceed the 20% drop anticipated by forecasters. Also, Reuters reported, an analysis shows that East Europeans count their pennies for Christmas as food costs soar. Food prices in Hungary were a staggering 45.2% higher in October than a year earlier, Eurostat data shows with 10 countries in the EU's east facing food price inflation of more than 20%. The cost of food was 33.3% higher in Lithuania and up 30% in Latvia compared to October 2021. And while there are signs headline inflation may be peaking in some countries, food prices are still rising strongly, adding to a cost of living squeeze and forcing central banks to keep interest rates high, even as economies started slowing sharply. Experts say local factors are exacerbating a global trend driven by rising energy and fertilizer costs, including low food industry productivity in some countries, heavy exposure to imports, and surging wages in tight labor markets. In Hungary, a severe drought decimated maize and wheat crops this year and caused animal feed prices to rocket, while the weak forint has raised import costs. Surging prices have started to dampen consumption. Food sales fell 5.6% in Hungary in October as families faced with year-on-year rises of over 34% for meat and fish and 80% for bread made savings. Czech shoppers, meanwhile, grappled with a 105% rise in sugar prices, while flour cost 45.4% more in Poland.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Talal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
As they came together for a summit in Brussels, EU leaders were acutely aware that energy storage tanks will run dry in the coming months. There are still major divisions in the EU over a gas price cap and a proposal to buy energy from international suppliers as one single customer.
It is important that we do not outbid each other as member states, but that we use the market power to purchase gas.
It's thought a deal might be finalised on Monday. There are plenty of other divisions within the 27-nation EU. Austria is blocking Romania and Bulgaria from the border-free Schengen area. Meanwhile, funding for Hungary is being withheld over rule of law issues.
Russia is blackmailing us every day. But if we start to blackmail each other, this is not good. And this is absolutely not good for the European Union.
A dark shadow of corruption is hanging over the EU. It emerged last Friday that Qatar has been bribing politicians and officials.
This scandal is a very serious matter indeed, which can shake trust in democracy and the parliamentary system. Thus, it is good that the Belgian authorities are thoroughly investigating.
At their summit, EU leaders refused to be drawn on the question of possible sanctions against Qatar. However, they signed off on more sanctions against Russia and also Iran. The leaders agreed to provide at least 20 billion euro to Ukraine in 2023. Campaigners say they should be doing more for their own citizens.
So many people in poverty, like everything what's going on from the crisis from 2008 until now, nothing changed.
It's clear that things could soon get a lot worse if the EU fails to secure a reliable long-term energy source at the right price. The costly Ukrainian refugee crisis is also growing by the day. So the final EU leader summit of 2022 has now concluded. Analysts say the unprecedented challenges they will face in 2023 could stretch the EU project beyond breaking point. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
While the West is expanding sanctions against Moscow and Iran over their military cooperation, the potential for developing relations between the two countries is huge, since Russia and Iran are under tough Western sanctions and therefore have little to fear.
The will of our governments is interconnected. Our high-ranking officials and our peoples do not pay attention to the shouts of the entire West and continue to strengthen their ties and interaction.
At the press conference held in Moscow, Iran's ambassador to Russia summed up the outcome of relations between Moscow and Iran in 2022. He noted that Russia's ruble is used in more than 40% of trade between the two countries and that the Russian currency may become the main one in bilateral trade. According to his remarks, Tehran supported the idea of using the ruble as the main currency in regional unions such as the EAEU. He also referred to efforts to integrate the national payment systems MIR and SHETAP as part of financial and economic cooperation between Russia and Iran. According to the Iranian envoy, Russia and Iran are seeking to reduce the dominance of certain currencies, including the dollar, in bilateral trade and economic relations. Jalali further said the automotive industry and space sector have become another field of cooperation between the two countries. In August, Russia launched remote sensing satellite Hayam into orbit on behalf of Iran.
As for our negotiations, I want to say that negotiations between our respective organizations in the field of outer space are ongoing on a regular basis.
Iran is investigating the possibility of producing cars jointly with Russia. Two leading automakers of the Islamic Republic, Saipa and Iran Hadro, took part in last summer's exhibition in Moscow and held negotiations with the Russian side. In addition to the joint production, the two countries are also discussing the possibility of sending Iranian cars to Russia. Russian and Iranian officials have time and again said that the two countries are determined to further expand bilateral cooperation. They have expressed confidence that the aim will materialize despite all the challenges the two nations might face, given the numerous capacities the two sides have. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In a mass rally and under a sea of green flags, men and women from all walks of life came out to take part in Hamas's 35th anniversary celebration. Hamas, who was founded in 1987, won the Palestinian parliamentary elections in January 2006, but remains blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime. The movement has fought several wars against the Israeli regime since 2007. The resistance movement said that Al-Quds, is at the center of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Hamas asserts today that Al-Quds is at the core of our struggle against the Israeli occupation. We're also sending a message of Palestinian unity. As we mark this day, we want to thank all Muslims and Arabs